Of course, the Lexus Golden Opportunity sales event is about exceptional offers, but it's also about the luxury of versatility and the freedom of a summer day coming together for you at the perfect moment.
Lease the 2019 UX250 Hybrid for $339 a month for 36 months with $39.99 due at signing. Experience amazing at your New York, New Jersey, Connecticut Lexus dealer. Call 1-800-USA-LEXUS for important lease offer and pricing details. Not all customers will qualify. Offer valid in the Lexus Eastern area only, and it's July 31st, 2019.
Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Hello, and welcome to the Hagman Report for Monday, July 15th, 2019. This is episode number 1920 of the program. I'm Peter Barry Chowka, and I'll be guest hosting for Doug Hagman on today's program. Doug is feeling a little under the weather, and due to congestion, he decided not to try to do the show today so he can get some rest. And as many of you know, Doug Hagman has had a stressful couple of weeks since the sudden death of his son, Joe Hagman, 16 days ago on June 29th. And Doug talked about what he's been doing, including mobilizing a serious professional investigation into Joe's death. Doug talked about this on last Friday's Hagman Report. That was July 12th, 2019, episode number 1919. And if you did not hear or see that episode, I highly recommend the video podcast of it at HagmanReportLive.com and also at YouTube, or the audio podcast at iTunes and all of the other audio platforms that carry this program. Now, before I get into today's show and what I have planned, and by the way, it will be 1 hour long today, a slightly shorter program, 1 hour today, and I'll be doing the whole thing. Before I get into it, I'd like to ask that those of you who are so inclined, that is people of faith, please continue to pray, or if you have not done so yet, to start offering prayers for Doug Hagman and the Hagman family, including our late dear friend Joe Hagman, who left us much too soon and who many of us are still thinking about and missing. And as I said, Doug has been working nonstop on a variety of stressful tasks in the last 2 weeks. So his immunity is probably low, and he could use prayers for his quick recovery from his not feeling well today so that he can return to hosting the Hagman Report as soon as possible. So today, I'm sorry that Doug isn't here, because he and I compared notes last evening, and he was looking forward to engaging with me on what I have planned for today, which is supposed to be my regular Monday appearance on the Hagman program. And today it's going to be a serious connect the dots analysis that will start with breaking news and go back 50, 60 years or more to hopefully help us understand what's going on in the country right now today, in hopes that we may be able to defeat it. But first, I just want to mention what's been breaking yesterday and today, Sunday and Monday, July 14th and 15th. Over the weekend, this past weekend, with the ICE actions, that is Immigration and Customs Enforcement actions, to arrest illegal aliens, these arrests that have been kicking up so much dust in the media, well, President Trump tweeted disparaging comments about, in particular, the four new members of Congress, the radical women who have been attacking him, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley. And these latest tweets by President Trump are being characterized by the media, the Democrats, the establishment, and so on, as racist and totally unacceptable. And we will see where the story goes from here, if it has legs, as they say, but it does not seem like a positive development. Earlier today, I received an email from a friend of mine, a friend of the program, who happens to be a Black American. She's close to me in age, she has a PhD, and she's a Trump supporter. She didn't comment explicitly on what the president tweeted, but her concluding sentence was very alarming. Quote, "Oy vey, what is he thinking?" Meaning President Trump, what is he thinking? Why does he say these things? I think his reelection is doomed, end quote. Oy vey indeed. When I hear intelligent Christian people like her who support the president say these things, I get very concerned. Now, on to the topic at hand. And this will represent, or does represent, several days of independent, intensive research and analysis. And these are, in effect, what I'll be talking about in the next hour. These are, in effect, the research notes that I used for an article which I've submitted for publication, although it has not been accepted yet. So you'll be hearing all of this first today, right here on the Hagmann Report, in an exclusive. And here's what some of what got me thinking about this new line of research and analysis. Last week, as I saw video of the hordes of invaders who were crashing into the country, an old leftist communist song or slogan started running through my mind. The people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated. That was what marchers on the far left used to chant when they would be demonstrating in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere way back in the day, starting in the starting around 1970, actually. And for some reason, that awful chant popped into my mind. And I thought, in light of everything that's happening now on the border with the invasion, the truth in that slogan today is that there are tens of millions of new people, illegal aliens, who have invaded this country, and not only recently, not only in the last few months or years, but going back decades. And these invaders have, in effect, flipped many states from Republican red to Democrat, socialist, communist blue, essentially reconquering the southwestern states, or a number of them, for Mexico and Latin America. And here's something that really got my blood boiling last week. As part of an anti-ICE demonstration, that is a demonstration against Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a mob in Aurora, Colorado, raised the Mexican flag at an illegal alien detention facility there. Meanwhile, the mob dragged the American flag down, pulled it down from its flagpole, desecrated it, spray-painted it, and ran it back up the pole upside down, while the Mexican flag flew beside it, or even higher than this desecrated American flag. Now, when I saw that video, all I could think of was rats and vermin have invaded and weakened our country and undermined its very foundation. If those actions in Aurora, Colorado were not an example of Reconquista in action, I don't know what is. Reconquista, meaning the radical Latino or Chicano, as they used to be called, advocacy of reconquering or retaking the American Southwest from the United States and returning it to Mexico. Now, there are so many tens of millions of illegal aliens here now, we don't even know how many. The lieutenant governor of Texas has been saying it's at least 30 million. Others put the figure even higher. I would tend to agree with those higher figures. But now that there are so many tens of millions of them here, I think a critical mass has been achieved. That's why the Democrats have flipped and in the last 5 years or so have gone full open borders. They now support wide open borders, and anybody who can get here from anywhere should be allowed to stay, according to the Democrats. That's what their message is, especially leading up to the elections next year. And they think that's going to be a winning message. because they realize, that is, the Democrats realize, that these illegals are the ticket to their amassing and keeping total power and control of this country, the United States of America, in the future, making, they hope, the whole country a one-party nation state like California has become. California, which used to be a Republican state until fairly recently, and now the Republican Party has basically been put out of business in California. It's a one-party state because, I think it's safe to say, of immigration, particularly illegal immigration. Now, even if all of the illegals in this country are not voting, their presence here in these massive numbers is still affecting the whole landscape of the country, including the political landscape and the dialogue. Now, look what's been going on with the 2020 census and President Trump's unsuccessful attempt to have the census include a question to be asked of people who take the census. Everybody's supposed to answer the census next year. Everybody was here. He simply wanted to include a question which has been asked on, I think, 10 previous census reports of, are you an American citizen? This is now being construed as racist and completely unacceptable by the Democrats and also by the courts, which have disallowed this question from being asked on the 2020 census. So all of this that's going on, most of it, if not all of it today, represents a revolution that we are now seeing. A similar revolution, or an analogous revolution, was tried, was attempted in the 1960s, but it was only moderately successful because the people then were not down with it. But the people who are here now are totally different. But the seeds were planted back then in the 1960s. In 1968, for example, the assassinations, the riots at the Chicago Democrat Convention, that and other things led to the election that fall, 1968, of Richard Nixon as president. It was a classic case of problem, reaction, solution. Then Nixon's perceived or real excesses took him down and resulted in the election of the Trilateral Commission New World Order candidate, Jimmy Carter, supposedly the peanut farmer. Right. Well, he was in office from 1977 to 1981, but Carter was such a disaster that his failures led directly to the election of Ronald Reagan as president in 1980. And after 8 years of Reagan, George Bush the elder was a placeholder for Reagan's legacy and became president for 4 years. Then we got to 1992, and the worm turned, so to speak, with saxophone-playing sex addict Bill Clinton elected. That's when things really started to go downhill. Clinton's 8 years led to Bush the younger. And then Barack Obama, who cemented the transformation, or the beginnings of the transformation, from which, in my opinion, there was no turning back. Now, these electoral shows every 4 years are just that. They're like sideshows, the plays that distract us and that we watch, while the real show or shows are going on, not necessarily in our view, deep behind the scenes. Now, what ensured the transformation that Obama promised in 2008 when he was running? What ensured that were a number of things. The corruption of higher education and the poisoning of the minds of young people. The ongoing cultural revolution that has now reached new levels of depravity in the mainstream media, films, television, music, and, as I've just been talking about, the invading the country with tens of millions of enemies of America, which unfortunately so many of these illegal aliens are. They're attacking our founding documents, the founders themselves, and the application of law and even our language, English. Now, I will present here today, in the next 45 minutes, essentially the research for this new article of mine. And it's an ultimate connecting the dots piece. Part of the inspiration was the news of today, this growing disbelief and shock to see what's happening and feeling powerless and largely impotent to influence it. So I'm titling this article that I submitted for print, The Roots of AOC's Green New Deal, Transformation, Communism, and Control. And AOC, of course, refers to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the most popular and influential Democrat politician in the country in her first term in the Congress. She's a die-hard, hardcore socialist / Marxist communist. Now, the subtitle for my story is A Story That May Have Gone Under the Radar Rears Its Ugly Head. And it begins with this. In a video from last December 18th that has only recently gained attention, AOC's brain, that is the person who selected her, runs her office, and programs her, and there he is on the screen, Saikat Chakrabarty, Saikat Chakrabarty. In that photograph, taken from a video that he did last December 18th, he's wearing a t-shirt with the face of Subhas Chandra Bose, or possibly Subhas Chandra Bose, who was an Indian nationalist, that is India from the subcontinent of India, who was allied with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan during World War II. And that's the t-shirt with that character's face, who AOC's chief of staff in her congressional office, that's who he is celebrating, wearing a t-shirt of a Nazi supporter and a supporter of Imperial Japan, are two enemies in World War II. Now, that picture should give us an indication of part of the lineage of the ideas of AOC and her brain, Chakrabarty, including their advocacy of what they call the Green New Deal, which has been getting a lot of publicity lately. Another hint of the agenda behind the scheme, their scheme, is contained in the Washington Post's fawning profile of Chakrabarty that was published several days ago. This long article begins with a meeting that Chakrabarty had with Sam Ricketts, who's the climate director of Governor Jay Inslee's campaign for president. There's the article, the top of it on the screen. By the way, if you're watching this, that picture shows Chakrabarty posing outside of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's office on Capitol Hill. There's the door to her office on the right. Covering the wall outside her office are hundreds of Post-it notes stuck on the wall with various messages left by AOC's fans that they hope that she will read. Incredible. Another picture worth a thousand words. Anyway, Chakrabarty met with Jay Inslee, the Democrat governor of Washington, his climate director, because Inslee is running for president. He's one of the two dozen or so Democrats running. And he's basing his entire campaign virtually on his draconian plan to combat climate change. So here's what the Washington Post article opens with. Chakrabarty had an unexpected disclosure. Quote, this is Chakrabarty, quote, "The interesting thing about the Green New Deal is it wasn't originally a climate thing at all, because we really think of it as a how do you change the entire economy thing. How do you change the entire economy thing, end quote. Well, change it to what? Change it to from capitalism to socialism, Marxism, communism. Because that's what these two, Chakrabarty and AOC, are into. AOC is a card-carrying member of the Democrats Socialists of America. More on them later. But these people are communists, basically. So that's what they want to change our free market economy to. So according to its key author, AOC's brain, the Green New Deal is not about climate change at all, or at most only incidentally. The real agenda is a socialist Marxist transformation of the country, starting with a complete government takeover and regulation of the economy, essentially pounding the last nail in the coffin of what remains of free market capitalism. At last count, the House resolution supporting this Green New Deal, it's been co-sponsored by six of the major 2020 presidential candidates, Senators Bernie Sanders, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and Amy Klobuchar. All six of them support this socialist, Marxist, communist Green New Deal. A point to be made here. These people in the Democrat Party who are suddenly so influential either call themselves socialists or advocate ideas that are referred to as socialists. They are no longer shy or embarrassed about saying they're socialists or that they support socialism, things like Medicare for all, which is socialist medicine, socialized medicine. But the question comes up, are they also Marxists or communists? Well, I would argue that the answer is yes. Last summer, exactly at this time, I was investigating the Occupy ICE movement. The support for that ragtag group by Democrats and the role of the Democratic Socialists of America in Occupy ICE. Now, the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, is a nonprofit, 501c4 tax exempt organization. It's not a political party, but it works to elect socialist candidates, particularly who are Democrats, running as Democrats. It is the leading socialist organization in the country. But is it Marxist or communist? Yes. If you go to its website, the DSA promotes right on the website an extensive online course that you can take on Marxism, the roots of communism. Now, the DSA's platform, and remember, Ocasio-Cortez and presumably her brain are members of this group. The DSA supports eco-socialism, socialist feminism, anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism, anti-racism, and anti-fascism. That's all at their website. And today when I went to their website, the DSA had an article screaming, "Solidarity with Iran." So it is clearly a Marxist-communist organization as far as I'm concerned, and not only me. It was last year, last summer, that I first went to Diana West, the brilliant historian and author who's been on this program a number of times. Her latest book is The Red Thread, in which she lays out a lot of this on how communists have been so influential in United States politics and life in the last century. Well, when I needed a quote for an article on all of this that I was writing last summer, actually several articles for the Epoch Times, I asked Diana West, are these people, the DSA, Occupy ICE, etc., communist? She said, absolutely. So AOC and Rashida Tlaib, one of the two new Muslim female members of Congress, they are two of the four members of the Squad, as these radicals call themselves. At least two of them are members of the DSA, and the other two members are Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and she's actually representing the constituency that used to be John F. Kennedy's seat in Boston when he was first elected to the House of Representatives. What a travesty that is. And the other member is Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, who was born outside the United States. She's the one who wears the hijab. I think that's what it's called, isn't it? Or whatever, that headgear that she wears always, including on the floor of Congress now. Now, this news about Chakrabarty, AOC, and the squad got me to thinking about some of the major, if less widely recognized, origins of this Green New Deal going back a ways. These ideas have arisen partly out of pagan Gaia worship, substituting the veneration of planet Earth for God. This Gaia worship is a growing New Age type cult religion inspired by global cooling, then global warming, then climate change, and what has now emerged fully birthed as the Green New Deal. By the way, speaking of global cooling, 44 years ago in 1975, there was a Newsweek story, a Newsweek article, and I'm not sure if we have that visual, but I grabbed a copy of that offline. This article, Newsweek, April 1975, suggesting that the environmental crisis, the climate crisis that was looming, was global cooling. The Earth was getting cold. We were going to have maybe a new ice age. So, that prediction was a little off, wasn't it? So then came global warming a few years later. There it is. There's the article, Newsweek. Science is the area there. And under that, the article title, The Cooling World. And there's a map of the Earth, areas of Earth affected by climatic change. And these are areas that were cooling, supposedly, in 1975. Well, what happened? The predictions were that we were going to enter this serious climate crisis of cooling and maybe another ice age. And instead that flipped and it turned into global warming, which is another scam, obviously. And now where are we going? Well, now they've got all their bases covered with climate change and the Green New Deal. Now, the combination of green with New Deal is significant. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Reverend FDR, the first socialist president in the United States, who promised when he was running for the office in 1932 that he would enact a New Deal for America. America that was in the throes of the Great Depression, with unemployment reaching 25% and many people suffering, if not starving. Now, that's what won the presidency for FDR in 1932, this New Deal promise. Much like Barack Obama rode a bad economy or the perception of one and his promises of a hope and change to electoral victory 76 years later. And as Diana West and other historians and authors have documented, the communists in our midst began their dirty work a century ago. The long march of Marxist ideas imported from Europe that took root particularly in the labor movement and corners of academia in the 1920s and 30s, well, that was interrupted, thank God, during World War II and the post-war period, which was the height of the American century. Now, some Republican politicians around then, late 40s, early 50s, were perceiving the dangers of domestic communists who were working inside of our government. And they tried to do something about this problem, personified by Senators Joseph McCarthy, Republican of Wisconsin, and Richard Nixon, Republican of California, and others. But when Senator McCarthy was made the scapegoat for a modern-day witch hunt and taken down, the history of that period was rewritten, and he and so-called McCarthyism were made examples of the worst excesses in American political life, supposedly. No matter that there was red penetration at the highest levels of government and espionage that resulted in the Soviet Union obtaining vital U.S. nuclear bomb-making secrets, which allowed them to develop and start using the hydrogen bomb. Now, after McCarthyism was demonized, there was no stopping the communists. They regrouped here and went forward, buttressed by a new generation of children who were born before and during World War II, and followed significantly by tens of millions of spoiled, impressionable baby boomers who started to be born in 1946 and 47 after World War II and for about the next 20 years. Now, in the 1960s, the decade when the oldest baby boomers were coming of age, everything started to change. It was the decade that socialism of the Marxist-communist kind became turbocharged. Communism was like a stealth jet fighter airplane sent screaming into the future. Not every baby boomer, of course, was or became a card-carrying communist. Far from it. They were more like, most of them were more like useful idiots. All that was required was an adjustment of many young people's thinking to make them susceptible to feeling guilty about things like slavery, income inequality, and harm to the planet that we humans were supposedly causing with our greenhouse gases and our lifestyles. Now, post-brain adjustment, they were fertile grounds for left-wing manipulators. An appalling number of people who did that, have their brains adjusted, would carry this sense of guilt for being white, for being middle class, for being successful. They would carry this well into adulthood, even until today. Now we're getting to the crux of this story. In 1962, a group of dedicated young Reds, communists, met at Port Huron, Michigan, on Lake Huron, north of Detroit, to plot the socialist communist takeover of the United States. Their vehicle was the radical group Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS. This band of radical agitators was formed in 1960. It was the U.S. equivalent of the small group of Bolshevik radicals that took over Russia a half a century earlier. The SDS had learned from the failures of the earlier generation of communists in the United States, who had dabbled with attempts at violent revolution, often in sync with the anarchists who were active during that period in the early 20th century. All of those violent attempts were unsuccessful because the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s, despite the Depression, when the commies started to rear their ugly heads, the U.S. still had a viable patriotic middle class, a viable education system that hadn't been corrupted by left-wingers, a strong Judeo-Christian foundation, and traditional family values. These qualities essentially inoculated most Americans against this communist influence. A lot of the country also was still agrarian, with many people living on small farms, and that did not hurt the prospects for a future America that was grounded and that respected the free market, the capitalist past, and the capitalist future. In fact, a statistic I turned up was that in 1920, the U.S. population, which was about 105 million, well, 31.6 million of those Americans were living on family farms. So almost one-third, or at least 30% of Americans were living on farms. Today, I think it's 1 or 2% at most. And, you know, if you live and work on a farm, that goes hand in hand with conservatism, traditional life, patriotism, etc. Now, this SDS meeting in 1962 in Michigan, which few, if any, took note of at the time, except the hardcore radical participants, this meeting issued the Port Huron Statement, which was a manifesto calling for a revolution that would begin on college and university campuses and spread throughout society from there. I repeat, the revolution would begin on college and university campuses and spread throughout society from there. Now, the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, had been formed in 1960 at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. And envisioning a new frontier ahead, the organizers of the SDS immediately distinguished themselves from the moribund and doctrinaire old left, and they saw their new campus-based group as the vanguard of a new left. These new communists derived their inspiration from things like Fidel Castro's triumph in taking over Cuba in 1959, the emerging cultural revolution in Mao Zedong's Red China, and the communists in North and South Vietnam fighting the U.S. in the rapidly expanding Vietnam War. At Port Huron in June 1962, among the participants, in fact, you could say the leading participant, was Tom Hayden. Hayden was the principal author of the Port Huron Statement, this SDS manifesto. A few years later, Hayden was one of the Chicago Seven radicals who were arrested and put on trial for fomenting the mob riots at the Democrat National Convention in Chicago in August 1968. In the next decade, the 1970s, Hayden would go on to marry Hanoi Jane Fonda and get elected to multiple terms in the California State Assembly and California State Senate, serving a total of 18 years. But even more significant than that, during Jerry Brown's first two terms as governor of California, 1975 to 1983, Tom Hayden was one of Jerry Brown's most influential advisors on a variety of policy issues, all of them extremely left-wing. Now, at this point, I want to turn to some photo evidence of the influence that this radical communist, Tom Hayden, had on California and indeed national politics. And Eric, by the way, Eric the Tech is directing this program from the Hagman Report studios in Northwestern Pennsylvania, as I am guest hosting for Doug Hagman today from my undisclosed location far away from Pennsylvania in flyover country. But Eric, if you have the first photo, which is the one showing the whole group, including Jerry Brown at the microphone on the right, and then the other five or six characters on the left. And I will set this photo up. It was taken, there it is. This photograph was taken in July of 1976 by me, Peter Barry Chalka. And the occasion was the Democrat National Convention in New York City, July 1976, which would nominate Jimmy Carter for president. But speaking at the microphone here, addressing the California delegation, was then governor of California, Jerry Brown, in his first term. Brown had declared his candidacy for the Democrat presidential nomination that year only 3 or 4 months before. And he actually ran a strong race at the very tail end and wound up being the last challenger left standing to Jimmy Carter. So he, in his first campaign for national office there, was having kind of a triumphant moment. So he's addressing his delegation. I was there covering the convention with credentials, photographing, recording, interviewing. And in that photograph I snapped, we see from left to right, and I will describe this for people who are just listening, but if you're watching this, from left to right, Cesar Chavez, the Chicano, he was called then, leader, the farm workers union organizer, who has now become a demigod in the state of California with his birthday, I believe, a state holiday. Schools are closed, get the day off from work, etc., to honor him. Behind him, you can see his bald head and his eyes, is Senator Alan Cranston, who at the time was 62 years old. He was in the middle of his long career as a United States senator. By the way, Cesar Chavez was 49 years old when this picture was taken, and he would pass away, I believe, in 1994 when he was in his early 60s. Next to Senator Cranston is Tom Hayden, having cleaned up his act and shorter hair, wearing jacket and tie. Next to him, his wife, Jane Fonda, Hanoi Jane herself, who he had married about 3 years before that. Next to them, the other sitting California United States Senator, John Tunney, in the last year of his first and only term. He would lose his reelection campaign later that fall to the Republican S.I. Hayakawa. Then I think there's a security individual. And then finally, on the extreme right, Governor Jerry Brown. So there on the stage, we have Cesar Chavez, the most prominent internationally known labor union grassroots leader in the United States. Two sitting senators from the state of California, the governor of the state of California, and Tom Hayden. I mean, what could indicate a more powerful and influential presence of Hayden and Jane Fonda having been welcomed to share that stage with those luminaries of California and national politics in 1976? And by the way, it was only 6 years before that that a long-haired, disheveled Tom Hayden was on trial, took about a year or more to come to trial, for his actions allegedly stoking the mob at the riot that ensued at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August of 1968. So, I don't know. Eric, I don't know if you have the photo. I grabbed part of a photo of the seven Chicago's eight, actually, there were eight originally, including Bobby Seale, but he was separated because he could not control himself in the courtroom, so it became the Chicago Seven. And there was a photograph of Tom Hayden taken by a famous photographer at about the time of the Chicago Seven trial, just a few years before he appeared on the stage. You know, he cleaned up his act and appeared on the stage, and it was a very, very different Tom Hayden. We'll see if we have that photo. If we do, that can be put on the screen, but it's not really critical. If you go online and search Tom Hayden images, you'll find a plethora of them from his early days when I believe it was this photo that I had in mind where Hayden is definitely, yes, there he is, Tom Hayden, the revolutionary. I don't know what that pair of pants represents, but they're too short. It looks like he got them at a Goodwill shop for 25 cents. And instead of wearing a belt, he's wearing some kind of rope or cinch that is tied in front of his fly. His pants are too short. He's gone on. Will look like boots, you know, the long hair. And yeah, about 6 or 7 years later, he's hobnobbing with the most elite and powerful politicians in the state of California, which at the time, I believe, was the number two largest state, moving into the number one position. And, you know, it just a few hours ago, I discovered a truly amazing document. It's a 14,000-word file by journalist Roger Canfield, written in 2011. It's part of an unpublished biography of Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden, and it focuses in incredible detail with more than 100 footnotes on the success of Jane Fonda and in particular Tom Hayden in connecting with and influencing Governor Jerry Brown starting in the early 1970s before Brown even ran for governor. Now, in that period, these two individuals, Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda, I think it could be said, were potentially traitors to the United States. We know about Jane Fonda going to Vietnam, North Vietnam. I believe it was 1972 when we were still at war with North Vietnam. And she ran around Hanoi. She sat for photographs and films on a large anti-aircraft gun, smiling and cheering the enemies of the United States. These were the guns that were used to shoot down American pilots who were flying bombing runs over Vietnam, killing many of them, and others wound up in horrendous conditions as POWs. Turns out that according to this file by Roger Canfield, Hanoi Jane's trip to Vietnam was organized by none other than Tom Hayden, because he had made several trips to Hanoi during the war, earlier during the Vietnam War, working against the interests of the United States, and had also met with North Vietnam representatives in Europe to try to strategize how the United States could lose the war. Mind-boggling stuff. So back to the SDS. Tom Hayden's brainchild, the SDS, in the early mid-60s, targeted racism and established the meme of participatory democracy. In other words, putting an end to a constitutional representative republic. Quoting the Port Huron statement here, this is really the money quote here. The civil rights and peace and student movement are too poor and socially slighted, and the labor movement too quiescent. It should rally support and strengthen itself by looking to universities, which benefit from their permanent position of social influence and being the only mainstream institution that is open to participation by individuals of nearly any viewpoint, end quote. This was the prescription for revolution, for the start, for the genesis of revolution to take down the United States, as published by the Students for the Democratic for a Democratic Society in 1962. Those words written by Tom Hayden. Now, a large part of the success of propagandizing the masses, especially young people, to embrace socialism and then communism was facilitated, as we've discussed before, by the Cultural Revolution that would come in the 60s, including sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This axis of evil influence hypnotized and brainwashed young people, especially college students. It helped to tear them away from their long-established moorings, including their families, and also began the downfall of traditional Judeo-Christian religious faith that had been the cornerstone of the nation since its founding, and which had provided the raison d'etre for the first English-speaking settlements here in North America in the early 1600s. Now, as we explore the roots of the Green New Deal further, I want to move past the rest of the 1960s and ahead to 1970 and something called Earth Day. The first Earth Day took place on April 22, 1970. It was the idea of liberal Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, Democrat, of course. He was a hero to the left who embraced a wide variety of far-left positions. He was an early environmentalist and a staunch opponent of the Vietnam War. Now, in the fall of 1969, the so-called moratoriums, organized by the New Mobilization, or the New MOB, represented the high watermark of the massive demonstrations against the Vietnam War. But also in the fall of 1969, Senator Gaylord Nelson came up with the idea of Earth Day. He foresaw it as promoting local demonstrations and teach-ins, advocating environmental awareness and action at high schools, colleges, and universities all over the country. It was inspired by, his idea was inspired by and modeled after the 1960s anti-war teach-ins on American campuses that successfully laid the groundwork for the ensuing anti-Vietnam War peace movement. These fledgling actions, including Earth Day, planted the seeds for academia to gradually but inexorably take the lead in instilling and then spreading far-left ideology and ideas throughout the mainstream of society by corrupting the minds of the youth and influencing them in their subsequent careers. Riding the wave of feel-good environmentalism, these were among the first steps in the successful mainstreaming of left-wing radicalism. Now, the left had tried to mainstream communism before with their attempts to use the labor movement and its organizations like unions and civil rights groups, but they couldn't get traction. Their efforts failed to move the ideological needle beyond these limited constituencies and did not move them into the mainstream of American life and politics. But the colleges and universities of the 1960s and 70s wound up providing the perfect environment, a sociological petri dish to grow these communist-inspired ideas, including social justice, the division of Americans into hyphenated racial, ethnic, and sexual special interest groups, and environmental activism. Now, here's an interesting connection. The first Earth Day took place on April 22, 1970. It was an ad hoc, local, feel-good, Age of Aquarius-type party on a nice day in early spring. I remember students at my campus that day sunning themselves on the lawn, listening to some speeches, throwing frisbees, and sending off balloons into the blue sky. Environmental apocalypse seemed far away. It was pretty much apolitical. Of course, that would change in later years when Earth Day continued every year as it does to this day, and it's gone international, in fact. Now, a significant coincidence is that 7 days later, after the first Earth Day, that is April 29, 1970, the Nixon administration launched the invasion of Cambodia, which was seen as an expansion of the Vietnam War that President Nixon had promised to end. The intent was to cut the supply lines of the Army of North Vietnam, who were invading our ally, South Vietnam, supplying the Viet Cong guerrillas and staging attacks from the adjacent, supposedly neutral Southeast Asian nation of Cambodia. At the time, Cambodia was a monarchy under Prince Norodom Sihanouk, who was friendly to the communists. As the news of the Cambodian incursion spread, all hell broke loose. The anger on campuses was palpable, and violence ensued on many of them. The fierce opposition on the campuses led to a student strike that shut down hundreds of colleges and universities. Many of them canceled classes for the rest of the spring semester, including final exams. It was barely controlled chaos from coast to coast. The killing of 4 students by National Guard troops at Kent State University in Ohio on May 4, 1970, during a demonstration against the Cambodian incursion, further inflamed the opposition to Nixon's actions. Student radicals organized massive demonstrations, and the largest one took place 10 days after the invasion began, on Saturday, May 9, 1970, on the Ellipse near the White House. I was there, and it was one of the largest demonstrations in memory, with about 500,000 people. And again, that was barely 2 weeks after Earth Day. So I think one kind of wound up influencing the other, the soft core followed by the hardcore. Now, although the era of massive anti-Vietnam War demonstrations was coming to an end at that point in 1970, many of the radicals who honed their organizing skills in the 60s took the advice of the Port Huron Statement and set their sights on academia. The SDS functionary and Weather Underground domestic terrorist Bill Ayers is probably the best example. And Eric, if we have that picture of Mr. Ayers from his mugshot in 1968, that's another interesting photo to review. Yes, Bill Ayers, August 27th, 1968. He later went underground for about a decade and only beat the rap because of some illegalities that supposedly were done by the FBI in pursuing him as a member of the violent Weather Underground. Now, others of his era went into politics, other radicals like Hillary Clinton, Tom Hayden, Bill Clinton, and Black Panther Bobby Rush, who's in the Congress now. And last but not least, a new generation of leaders taking power later or moving into positions of prominence today. Well, these would include Barack Obama, AOC, Ilhan Omar, and too many others to mention. These new ones, this new generation, are carrying the torch for what started in the 60s, much of it based on environmental radicalism, which took root in the 60s, expanded over the years, and has now morphed into the Green New Deal, one of the greatest Trojan horse threats to the future of the United States. So it's an interesting story, a complex one, and I've tried to highlight how the SDS, this small group of ragtag hardcore communists, set the ball rolling with their manifesto 57 years ago now. And their key individual, the key author of that manifesto, Tom Hayden, had a tremendous influence in California, but also nationally. In fact, he later met with and influenced Jimmy Carter when Carter was president. So it's an incredible story when you get into the depth of it. And, you know, here's something I think of. You know, the period when all of this was really germinating, the early 60s, I remember that period well. And in fact, I'm refreshing my memory because I'm following several favorite television programs from that very period, that very time in American life, 55, 57, 60 years ago, that are being broadcast on classic cable TV channels like MeTV and Antenna TV. The programs of that period, the culture of that period, the academic environment of that period in the United States, the colleges, the universities, the entertainment, you would have no idea that these rats, these communist rats, were gnawing away at what would become the heart of this country, its political dynamic, and they would reach a critical mass, starting with the regime of Barack Hussein Obama, who was one of their hardcore followers, and now with apparently every last major Democrat who's running for office, with only minor shades of disagreement among them about how far they should go down this socialist, Marxist, communist path. It's a sad, disgusting, and alarming story. But somebody has got to tell it. As I come to a close here in this special hour of the Hagmann Report today, Monday, July 15th, 2019, Peter Barry Chalka sitting in for Doug Hagmann, who's a little under the weather today. So your prayers for him, for his quick recovery, so he can get back here soon in the hosting role, your prayers are indicated, please. This is program number 1920. Again, if you could, please look into program number 1919, the one from last Friday, July 12th, which Doug Hagmann hosted. He had a lot to say there about what's been going on in his life in the last 2 weeks. And I would appreciate your visiting my website, which is peter.media. Also, my Twitter page, twitter.com/pchowka. That's twitter.com/pchowka. And if you're on Twitter, I would really appreciate your retweeting the tweets I publish that link to my articles and these broadcasts at the Hagmann Report. The tweets really do make a difference. The article that I wrote about Joe Hagmann, which was published 9 days ago in American Thinker, and I'm very proud of that article. I'm very happy with how it turned out to honor my friend Joe Hagmann. It is social media, people retweeting my tweets of that article, that helped to push it into the trending category so that it got a lot of readers, as it deserved, because of the subject, Joe Hagmann. I also have an email address where you can reach me, petercmedia@outlook.com. That's petercmedia@outlook.com. I welcome communications from members of the Hagman audience, and I certainly read every email I get if I can't always respond or respond in a timely manner. And tomorrow's program, we expect, will go on as scheduled with Stan Deo in the second hour. That is tomorrow, July 16th, 2019, Tuesday. And our best wishes for Doug Hagman. Thank you again for listening today. This is Peter Barry Chowka signing off the Hagman Report. Thank you. God bless you. Until next time, God bless America.
Need to get organized? Today is the day for doing with the Home Depot's Pack Store Save event. Put your basement or garage in order with a range of Husky welded steel shelves, including a four-tier 77-inch rack, just $169. That'll save you $30. Easy to assemble, each shelf has a lifetime warranty and holds up to 1,500 pounds. That gets a lot out of your way. Come into the Pack Store Save event only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Valid until August 25th while supplies last.
5-Hour Tea with caffeine from green tea leaves. It's delicious, energizing, and comes in three amazing flavors. With zero sugar and four calories, it fits your life. With its compact size and portability, it goes where you go. To the campsite, the hiking trail, the beach, without weighing you down. 5-Hour Tea, caffeine from green tea leaves. Release your natural side from the makers of 5-Hour Energy. For more information, visit 5hourenergy.com. Try 5-Hour Tea today. Look for 5-Hour Tea at your local Circle K store.